Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. This is just one segment of the show. Each weekday, Brian and his guests take on the topics of the day, and you can hear all of these conversations on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
Before the news, we heard the memoir of Steve Roberts, or heard him talk about his memoir. Steve Roberts, who grew up in Bayonne in the 40s and 50s, now a very different kind of remembrance. Medgar Evers was born in 1925 in Decatur, Mississippi. He grew up to be perhaps the most important civil rights leader you never heard of. He was field director for the NAACP until he was assassinated in Jackson, Mississippi, on June 12, 1963. His killer was finally tried and convicted in the 90s. Medgar Evers' widow, Merle Evers Williams, continued their civil rights work, going on to be chairwoman of the NAACP in the 1990s. Now 72, she has co-edited an autobiography of Medgar Evers built around his own writings, letters, and speeches. It's co-edited with the Columbia University professor you may know from this program or elsewhere, Manning Marable. The book is called The Autobiography of Medgar Evers, published by Basic Civitas Books, and it's a pleasure to welcome Merle Evers Williams to the WNYC studio. Good morning.
Good morning. And thank you very much for being allowing me to be on the show.
Thank you very much. And, of course, I said perhaps the most important civil rights leader you never heard of. At least people in Brooklyn, as I said before the news, know that we have Medgar Evers College here.
Yes.
As part of CUNY. Probably the name is even less known around the rest of the country.
Well, I think the name is known, or it's beginning to be known, but only as, up to today, the man who was assassinated in Mississippi June the 12th, 1963. With every book and publication that I have searched for his name, I found that one sentence, and it deals with his assassination and not with his life. And that's why it really became critically important to have documentation of Medgar's life, his living, what he was able to accomplish with the help of other people. And very honestly, Dr. Manning Marable has just been a dream person to work with. His concept of the need of this book has gone beyond my expectations. For me, it was a little difficult pulling the material together because it meant going back into the past and reliving all of these things all over again. But I'm so pleased that we now have this book in publication.
And we will get into the life of Medgar Evers, of course, as we go here. But tell our listeners a little bit about yourself first. You also have had a life in the movement, and you're the guest. So where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi. I'll even give you the date, March 17, 1933.
Okay.
I was educated in the public schools there, went on to one of the two state schools for Negroes, as we called ourselves then, Alcorn A&M College, and it was the first day, first hour that I met Medgar Evers with a group of football players, of which he was one, running toward this group of young freshman girls so they could check us out and make their selections at that point.
What did your parents do, and did you come from a big family?
No, a very small family, actually. I was reared by my grandmother, my father's mother, and his sister, my Aunt Merle, for whom I'm named. A very small community of Vicksburg, but they were, if I might call them, leaders in their community and in the church. emphasized education, both teachers, and they also emphasize the fact that you do not rock the boat. You let things stay as they are. And that was my life until I met Medgar, and that changed. But I was given the opportunity to study classical music from the age of 4 until I was 18. Those kinds of things were high on their list of accomplishments for me.
What do you remember about how segregation affected your childhood, and particularly your education, in a family and a personal context that valued education?
Well, as I look back over it now, my education was so substandard, as were that was the case for all of us of color. Our textbooks were old, our pages were torn out. We had chemistry classes, but we had no instruments, anything to perform any of the tests that we should have. No foreign languages were allowed to be taught to people of my color in that school. But we had something else that I think was critically important and may be missing some of this today. We had teachers who believed in us, teachers who made the most of whatever material that they had. Long before Jesse Jackson said, "You are somebody," they were instilling in us the fact that we had something that we could contribute to ourselves, our community, and eventually to our nation. And they built that self-confidence there, and their expectations of us were extremely high. So that was a big plus.
Why would there be less of that today if arguably there at least is some more equality in the schools?
Well, for one thing, we're living in a different time. We had small communities, and we took care of each other. We don't find that today. We're living in a different world. Grandparents are not necessarily living in the same household as children and grandchildren. We are busy with our lives and trying to make a way to survive in this society. The emphasis just does not seem to be there as much as it was during that period of time when I was growing up.
My guest is Merle Evers-Williams. She has now co-edited the autobiography of Medgar Evers. We can take phone calls for her at 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. How similar or different was Medgar's upbringing from yours?
Quite different, I believe. We both came from what we would call struggling poor families. And I hasten to say there's a difference between being poor and being poor in the South anyway. But his father, and he had a mother and father in his home. I grew up with my aunt and grandmother, so there was a difference there in terms of role models. Medgar's father was called Crazy Jim in his hometown, simply because Daddy Jim challenged the system there. We were not supposed to walk on sidewalks at that time. Daddy Jim said his family would. He told his boys, and they were boys at that time, that it was the right that they had to vote and that they should do it, even though they had had visitors from the Klan and others saying that you had not best do that. Medgar's mother also played a very important role in his life. And as you will find in the book, Medgar was not always one who said we should turn the other cheek. He wanted very much to start a tribe or so based on what Jomo Kenyatta was doing. As a matter of fact, he named our son Kenyatta. As well. So in Medgar's household, it was an activist household. In my household, it was one where you didn't rock the boat. And it was quite a change for me to come from one to the other.
Jomo Kenyatta, the first post-colonial leader of Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between poor and po?
when you are poor, you are struggling to make ends meet, but you have a place to live, you have food to eat, you have clothes to wear, even though they may not be of the best quality. When you are poor, you have nothing, and you're at the mercy of your community. But it's interesting that we always found some way to bring the poor in with the poor and with the somewhat affluent, and everyone nurtured and took care of each other. I love those terms, though.
So was it difficult for you, coming from a Don't Rock the Boat family, to commit to a life with him, coming from a Rock the Boat family, and knowing the risks and hardships of being with someone who would be an activist in Public Lightning Rod his whole life?
Yes, it certainly was difficult. I am here to say to you this morning that Metka and I had a rather difficult first year of marriage, because I had to make all of those adjustments. I was also 18 years of age and terribly inexperienced at that time. So not only was Metka my husband, but he was also my teacher in many different ways. But I later came to embrace all of the things that he did in social issues, as well as his work. Metka knew that he wanted to change things. He wanted to be an agent for change in his state. He fought in World War II at Normandy, and as he said, he came home and found that he was still a second-class citizen, as were everyone else of his race and color. He was determined to change that. There was no turning around. I did try to convince him that we should find other jobs and not be involved in that because of the danger. I was challenged by Metgar, and he said to me, either you're with me or you aren't. That's your decision. And, of course, you know what my decision was.
And you had 12 years married together, I guess, before he was killed.
Yes, and almost 12.
And the book makes it very clear that he was a public man, but also felt very rooted in the private life that he had with you and your three children. He was away from home a lot to do his work?
He was away from home all of the time, honestly. But he did make such an effort to get back, to spend time with the children, to be available when they were in school plays and activities, and to be an active part of their growth and development. And as he said, Merle, what I am doing is for my children, for you, and all of the other children and people who need to be able to be first-class citizens in America.
You wrote this book so that the work that he did, as you said before, not just his assassination, will be remembered. And we know the names Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and others, and could identify in a sentence or so the kind of work that they were most associated with. How would you begin to describe Medgar Evers' unique contribution to the struggle?
It's difficult to do that, but I describe Medgar as a pioneer civil rights activist. Metka was the one who came along with a few others and paved the way for Dr. King and all of the other well-known names that we associate with civil rights. He paved the way. He was there doing the dirty work, the hard work, before they got started. And for me to read books and see him listed only as a man who was assassinated at a certain time in Mississippi and nothing else, I found that I just couldn't tolerate that much longer.
So one of the things that I got from the book, and we have to take a break in 30 seconds, so you'll just start this answer, but one of the things that I got from the book was that he, part of his work was going around trying to integrate public schools?
That's short. What he was doing was developing branches for the NAACP, addressing all of the ills that existed in the state of Mississippi, and there were many, which I'll be delighted to get into when we come back on.
And we'll come back on, and you can do that. I also want to read a passage from the book that represents how much of the struggle he felt was internal, was to bring other African Americans in the South along into the struggle. And we'll pick it up from there, and we can take your phone calls from Merle Evers Williams at 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692. on WNYC with Merle Evers Williams, the widow of the civil rights leader Medgar Evers, assassinated in 1963. She has now co-edited with Manning Marable from Columbia University the autobiography of Medgar Evers, subtitled A Hero's Life and Legacy, revealed through his writings, letters, and speeches. You write in the preface to the book, quote, Negroes, the descriptive name used in the 50s, moved into three self-determined categories: the youth and the elders who boldly stepped to the drumbeat of freedom now, those who encouraged the slow legal process, and the middle class don't rock the boat mentality. The mix of ideologies sharpened the action plan for involvement and drew a wider national participation of activists. And you've already described how you came more from the don't rock the boat school than he did. Did the mix of ideologies impede the struggle because too many black Americans would rather not jeopardize whatever comfort they had at the time?
No, it did not, because those people who were so determined to rock the boat and see changes happened to be the stronger force there. They made more noise. They took more risk. They even forced some of those who said we must let things stay as they are. They forced them into the movement. And that was something that I think only a strategist like Medgar could help to build in a state of Mississippi, and something similar to that. We have to remember that that was a time when people attempted to register and vote, and they were told that they had to determine the number of beans in a jar, that they had to be able to tell us how many bubbles in a bar of soap. Such idiotic things as that. But still, they had to deal with the dogs, police dogs. They had to deal with the gassing. They had to deal with it all. And finally, the media found out that they really had some very good stories there and began to come in and report on these incidents, whereas before we had to send all the information out to New York to be disseminated. We were strictly bound behind the cotton curtain.
And much later in the book, you include the text of a speaking engagement of Medgar's from 1959, in which he says, quote, and I'm going to read a paragraph of this, "So often we find Negroes of means who could well afford to lead our people out of our present state, but are nevertheless content with things as they are because of the personal profit they receive from segregation and human misery. These people have been selected by whites as leaders of the Negro communities in an effort to stamp out any semblance of our fight for justice and equality by the more militant Negro people. Many of these Uncle Toms are given high educational posts, such as principals, superintendents, and even college presidents, to bolster their community prestige." And he goes on to rip some principals who take full advantage of this. So one thing the world may be tempted to forget, I guess, is that the struggle was within the community as well as outside of it.
The struggle was in the community, both in the local communities as well as the national community of civil rights. It was very painful to see friends, acquaintances, schoolmates see us and walk across the street not to have anything to do with us. It was very painful to see the only African-American newspaper call for Medgar's dismissal, if you will. But there were
Why did they?
Partly because, and Medgar says it here, because they were paid. It was profitable to them to do that. The Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, and those papers are available now, are as Medgar's at the Mississippi Department of Archives and History. Those papers spelled out in error so many of the things that did not take place. It was one of those things that was determined to make a split between us that was already there. On a national level, we found some envy that existed in the NAACP leadership of Dr. King and others, and we were told not to talk to each other. That there are fascinating stories in this book and the reports that speak to all of that.
Merle Evers Williams, my guest on WNYC, co-editor of the autobiography of Medgar Evers. And put on your headphones so we can take some phone calls from our listeners at 212-267-WNYC. Jamal and Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is for Mrs. Evers. I'm a university student. I would like to know what she believes. I think that a lot of what Ms. Evers has said in the past is still very relevant, especially within the struggle within our community and the black community. We have a lot of people making a lot of money on hip hop and that type of mentality, and it's doing nothing but destroying ourselves and destroying our neighborhoods, and all these people that are making all this money, they're not giving back to the community. In fact, what they are, they're like leeches and vampires on our community. And I come from Newark. I live in Teaneck now. I'm originally from Newark. I was one of six people that went to university from my high school class. The majority of them, man, I got so many friends that are dead in jail. It's crazy, and mm-hmm. It's just. I'd like to know what she thinks about the leadership now. Who's our leaders? Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson. These guys that are looking out for themselves. They go to talk to somebody with their hand out. What can we do? What can we do?
Well, you know, the fact that you are expressing your opinion is very, very important, and I think more and more people need to do that kind of thing in whatever way that they possibly can. Leadership is kind of catchy there. You can appoint yourself a leader, or you can be called as a leader, or you can be a servant leader, as Metka was, someone who saw an area of need and was determined in a pure sense of the word, to do something about it. I think as long as we stay aware of what is happening around us in our communities, our leaders, our elected officials, our appointed officials, where they stand, and we find a voice to speak out, whether it's on radio shows, in our churches, in our other groups, either for or against what they are doing, as long as we are actively involved. And that's the whole point of it. There are just too many people who say today, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether I vote. It doesn't matter whether I express my opinion. Nothing's going to happen. Well, it's just the contrary to that. And we have to be committed, and we have to find ways in which to do that.
Are you as down as Jamal is on the current leadership personified by some of the names he mentioned?
You know, the question of leadership, who are our leaders? And again, I go back to the media. Who bombarded our community for the longest period of time? Who is your leader? Who says that we have to have one leader? We have our churches, we have others, but again, I go back to the important point.
So you think Jamal has internalized that from white media?
I think he speaks for so many different people across the board, but I have to get back to Metka as an example of someone who saw those problems and found a way to address them and to put his life on the line. Hopefully no one else has to put their life on the line for this. But be vocal. Find like opinions with people and see what you can do as a group to express those opinions.
Jamal, thank you very much for your call. Keep your voice heard here, if you will. Joseph in Harlem, you're on WNYC.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, real quick, I have something to say about Mississippi, but Jamal should go down to National Action Network and find out about Sharpton, because a lot of times I hear folks who talk about Sharpton, they do get that just from the media, et cetera. But my father's from Mississippi, and he was telling, you know, he doesn't talk about it a lot, but he talked to me about the educational system. You know, thank God, you know, he became a top-notch architect now. But the educational system down there was horrendous. And your husband had to be super mental because, I don't know if you recall when they were looking for Cheney and Schwerner.
Mm-hmm.
When they,
dredged
part of the Mississippi River somewhere.
Yes, about a year after Medgar's assassination.
And they found those bodies, you know, and somebody made a song about it, one by one, two by two, and they didn't want to let the information out, the FBI, because they found so many bodies, chains, hangman's
that was still there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that were in this river. I mean, they were piled high. So Medgar was a very strong black man to go against, you know, what was going on down there. My father said that people were actually like afraid. You know, they walked into the street. They didn't, you know, that, you know, and not the street, you know, they
well,
they
we weren't supposed to walk on the sidewalks now.
It was horrible. You know, I don't think people realize that that was only, you know, four decades ago.
That's,
you know,
right.
That's not a
That's why, forgive me for interrupting you, and I just want to say this. That's why it's so important to get this book, because you can, the reader can go almost day by day in terms of the things that happened during that period
of time. So let me ask you about a particular instance of that, and Joseph, thank you for your call. I know you wanted to talk about Medgar's essay in the book, Why I Live in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a good thing to bring up right at this point.
Well, it's just a part of the book that I would emphasize to be sure to read, because it goes into the depth of his feelings about his people and his state. And he would say, I love the state of Mississippi. I love the state of my birth. I was born in Mississippi, too. But it was like, how can you love this place? But he did, and he was committed to making change. So that's one of the areas that I would be sure to ask the readers, the buyers, to go to perhaps even first to get an essence of the man, because I really found that I could barely take any more of the fact that he is listed certainly as a leader, but as an assassinated leader, and that's that. In the pages of this book, you will find the essence of the man, and I thank this gentleman who just called in for talking about the bravery, because he was unusually brave, as were so many other people, knowing full well that in challenging that kind of system, that they more than likely would pay for their lives, and cared enough to be able to continue to work and do that.
Dave in Karlstadt, you're on WNYC with Merle Evers-Williams.
Thank you very much for taking my call. And Ms. Evers-Williams, it's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
My story may be a little bit different from the previous callers. Is I'm a white male born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in the 1970s, and I just finished reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
Mm-hmm.
It had been on my life list of books to read, and I finally got around to reading it, and I'm really you know, blown away by the things that I read in there, and the fact that some of those things happened. And I found myself sitting up at night after I would finish a chapter or two saying, I can't believe that this just happened, that the abuse and the disrespect that occurred took place. And he wrote from the perspective of finding, as you were raised, I guess, not to rock the boat,
mm-hmm.
The way he wrote the book. And now I'm really looking forward to picking up Medgar's autobiography and reading how someone who was told to rock the boat came together with someone who was told not to rock the boat, and how you were able to bring so many changes. I almost see it as being a continuum of Invisible Man into how the whole movement progressed from shirk away to get out there and let's drive some change and make it happen. And I'm just looking forward to it, and I think it's developing me as someone who didn't experience this and who has been comfortable with race his whole life to sit there and say, now I can understand where some of this comes from. So I'm looking forward to it, and thank you very much for putting it out there for us.
Thank you so much. That's a wonderful endorsement.
Dave, thank you very much. And here, by the way, is the final paragraph of Why I Live in Mississippi. It may sound funny, but I love the South. I don't choose to live anywhere else. There's land here where a man can raise cattle, and I'm going to do that someday. There are lakes where a man can sink a hook and fight the bass. There's room here for my children to play and grow and become good citizens if the white man will let them. The youth have a definite responsibility to help, because mm-hmm. much of what we are struggling for now will benefit them directly 10 years from now, will open up opportunities that were not open when I came along. Violence certainly is not the way. Returning physical harm for physical harm will not solve the problem, and one of our strongest appeals to the conscience of Southern whites is that the NAACP has never been linked to violence. He wrote that in 1958-59.
Yes, and it's interesting how he went through changes, because Medgar at one point felt that the only way we could win as such was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and it was through his mother's prayers and cajoling with him to find other ways to reach the same goal that he had. And it's an amazing story. And I thank the gentleman who called and said Medgar was such a brave and strong man. That's what I hope will come through. And this time next year, people will say, I know the man, not that he was simply assassinated in June 1963.
And this time next year, the book will be out in paperback. You went on to be chair of the NAACP mm-hmm. in the 1990s. Are there particular threads of Medgar's work you felt that you carried on in your own work? Or just the
yes,
whole thing?
Yes, because I guess that common thread happened to be that this is the largest and oldest civil rights organization. It needs to go through changes periodically, but whatever state the organization might be in, we're dedicated to it and dedicated to making it stronger. Medgar gave me my first NAACP membership as a birthday gift years ago, and I tell you, I did not appreciate it at all. It was like, this is a gift. But I came to understand that it was one. And I'm loyal to the organization, to work to see change come about within it and to see it to become stronger as Medgar was. And what people don't know, that Medgar really was on the verge of leaving the association shortly before his death.
Why?
He was disillusioned with the progress, the seemingly inability for those in New York to understand what was happening in the South. He invited many of the people to come down and work with him and see for themselves what was going on. There was certainly a competition among civil rights groups, the old and the new, during that period of time. And there was this undercurrent of we don't need to talk or work with anyone else. And he couldn't tolerate that. It's like we are in all of this together and there's room for each and every group and opinion because we are all working toward the same thing.
We have about a minute left. Were you in the NAACP audience last year on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education? When Bill Cosby gave that controversial speech about parents and values and lack of involvement in education and their children's lives?
No, I was not in the audience.
What do you think of it?
In all honesty, I'm very glad that he spoke that. I don't think I would be quite as harsh as he was, but there's a lot of truth to it. We do find our strength, our wisdom to move forward in whatever arena we might be in through the family. And I would hope that as we move forward, our family as such becomes much stronger than what it is today because our youth are our future.
20 seconds. We had Michael Eric Dyson here recently talking back to Bill Cosby, in effect, in his new book. And he said Cosby was blaming the victim. Victim of racism.
Let me just raise this question. Victim of what? I am a victim, my people, are victims of prejudice and racism, inequality, and all of the other. But we must not make ourselves victims.
Merle Evers Williams, now co-editor of the autobiography of Medgar Evers, published by Basic Civitas Books. It's been a great honor for me. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.